Welcome to the Tom and Curly Show. Tom Tangney here, John Curly feeling under the weather, and Felix Fennell ably filling in at the last second. We much appreciated Felix for a big news day like today.
My pleasure. The meatier the story, the better, I always say. As my father always used to say, the meatier the story, the better.
I see. Well, we have a meaty story coming up. This is an amazing feat of journalism, if you ask me. And I think it might appeal to the sort of the historical archivist in you as well. Seattle Times has a front page analysis of urban villages. Now, you and I have both lived in Seattle long enough to probably remember the urban village theory and craze back in the Norm Rice days. Have you been in Seattle that long?
Oh, yeah, I've been here my whole life. I mean, I lived on the East Coast for a couple of years in my early 20s, but no, I'm born here and lived here my whole life. Yeah. No,
okay, perfect.
Urban villages are all the rage back in the early 90s.
That's right, and it makes perfect sense. In fact, I've always sort of clung to that as like, I don't know, ideals maybe too strong a word, but like a very strong public policy when it came to organizing a city. And so if you're not familiar with the urban villages, you'd recognize urban villages here in Seattle. It's like these little business communities that are have lots of apartments and townhouses and condos. They're like neighborhood hubs, and they have lots of shops and parks and buses, bus access and all. And they dot the city of Seattle.
The idea is that you have the density, density in certain areas, so it leaves other areas for open space and for less dense parts of the city. It lets you deliver services more efficiently. It lets you deliver transit more efficiently. It try to mimics the best parts of the really big cities of the world. And back in the 90s, it all sounded really abstract because there are very few parts of the city that you could point to and say, that's an urban village. We just didn't really have them that much, at least in my memory 30 years ago. And they only really start to spring up in the last 20 years. Like I noticed in Ballard, like along Market Street, where you have these 6-7-story condos, and then there's the ground floor. It's all about the ground floor retail with the 5 or 6 stories of apartments or condos above.
Yes, and it's a way to accommodate a rush of people without disturbing the general flavor of Seattle. So you'd have these urban villages. I mean, they were walkable and they were obviously urban, and you could pack a lot of people in, and then you wouldn't disturb a lot of the rest of Seattle, which were mostly zoned, single family zoning. And that worked well, I think, for the last, say, 20 of the last 30 years so. And you've got like the U District, you've got downtown, you've got Capitol Hill, you've got certain, I think of them as like business districts, but yes, it was high density. Now, what's interesting about that, though, is in the intervening 30 years, Seattle's population has grown by almost 800,000. So one could say that they did their job. They did it well because those are very dense and popular arrangements in the city. And yet, because the influx has been so strong that even Norm Rice, who incidentally is an African-American, and there's a kind of interesting rumble about the theory behind urban villages, but he was the one who introduced the topic. And the Seattle Times starts off its in-depth article talking to Norm Rice about, well, so Norm, you were a big urban village guy. What do you think? And he says, I think they served their purpose, but now they've outlived, their purpose, and we probably ought to come up with something else. And I find this fascinating because I think it's true. It's a Seattle-centric story, but it's going to be appropriate to discussions in Everett and Tacoma and Bremerton, perhaps, at some point. I mean, these are the kinds of dilemmas that counties around the state are, and the country, for that matter, are going to have to grapple with. What is wrong with urban villages? Have they outlived their welcome? And what seems to be designed better? And one of the things I remember, again, this was, 5 years ago, 6 years ago? Ed Murray, the now disgraced ex-mayor, but Ed Murray at the time had this study done, and they proposed doing away with single-family zoning, and there was such an uproar. It was like one of 34 suggestions about how to make Seattle a more livable place. There was such strong objection from the neighborhoods that they just, okay, we'll take that off. That won't be one. Well, now that time is re-entering the discussion, thanks to a lot of local politicians and the kind of philosophy of new city responses to things like homelessness or low-income housing or most importantly, and this is why the article was written, I think, racial equity, a new, big new analysis of racial equity suggests that perhaps urban villages are not the way to go. Here's a clip. I'll let you jump in here, but here's a clip from Tammy Morales, who's a present council member on the Seattle City Council.
We know that our racist housing policies like redlining and like the urban village strategy really have kept people from building generational wealth. And we know the way in which Seattle has grown in the last decade has also pushed people of color out of our city much faster and to a much greater degree than our white neighbors have been pushed out. We know this. So as we begin to strategize about what our next comprehensive plan looks like, how we right those wrongs, racial equity must be front and center in these discussions.
Okay, yeah, one last little piece of information. So every 8 years we have to do a comprehensive guide to where we see the city going, and 2024 is when the next one's being drawn up, and so that's what these initial studies are being drawn for. So it's clear and obvious, and we've talked a lot about it on the show, redlining is as racist comes. It's the old, situations where minorities, especially African-Americans, blacks, were not allowed to live outside of what in Seattle was like the Central District. They were not mm-hmm. allowed even to. That one, no one defends that anymore. But I was struck by the suggestion that even the notion of urban villages, which at least at the time in the 90s, we weren't thinking along racial lines at all, could now be seen as somewhat racist in their design. Take it from there.
And then it perpetuates the disparity in the cost of housing, because one of the things that the urban villages have succeeded in, that they have managed to create these dense neighborhoods in these business districts that are close to transit, close to amenities everybody mm-hmm. needs. Check, that worked. But they haven't done anything to keep the property values from just going, you know, to the moon in terms of the rate of inflation. And property is still very inaccessible to most people to try, like first time home buyers and that sort of thing. And then it's perpetuated this notion that these expensive single family homes that still make up a huge percentage of Seattle's zoned areas are not affordable for many people of color. And it's created this sort of, I don't know, like an economic redlining or a market-based redlining or market-based sort of these covenants that kept people of color or certain ethnic backgrounds from purchasing specific homes in specific areas.
Okay.
So it's tricky. Go ahead. No, I was going to say it's tricky. The problems is where the urban village bumps up against the non-urban village. I've seen this in a university district now. There's all these little tiny houses that maybe they're duplexes and triplexes. Mm-hmm. Those are being torn down and replaced by tall, skinny condo buildings, or three or four houses are torn down and a big condo building goes in, and you create these really odd neighborhoods that are a mixture of dense apartments and single family or maybe two family, three family homes. And it just makes it just, it just aesthetically, it's a mess, number one, but it also just creates this, there's no place for anyone to park. A lot of these new buildings don't have places to park your car. Some of the houses don't have off-street parking. Yeah, exactly. No, it's part of the whole strategy of getting people to rely on mass transit.
Yes. Yeah.
I love the idea of creating a utopian Seattle for 100 years from now that I'll be long dead once it's ready to go, because I like my single-family house in North Seattle. Yeah. I like parking my car on the street. I like all this stuff about – it's not just the old Seattle. It's sort of the old 20th century American way of life, and maybe it's a white privilege thing. I don't know. But it's just this notion of, and the notion of losing that. I think if the zoning changed in my neighborhood in Wallingford, I would be the first on the block to build a mega tower. I'd mow my house down and put up a big condo, and I'd live on the top of it and have five or six floors below me.
Okay, now why do you say that? Are you being funny?
How would you like to be? Well, what if your neighbor did that? I mean, again, it's when the zoning changes, there's always a time when it happens. There's that period where the first house on the street gets converted to something else, or the first two houses are bought and then, you know, put together.
And you would want to do that because you could then cash in and still live there.
I wouldn't want to be sitting there in my single family house while, you know, I'm surrounded by big, big, tall buildings are blocking out the light and the views and everything. You know, it's the ugly adolescence of a city's development that all the policies in the world, even Norm Rice 30 years ago, nobody could foresee or could get away or get around the fact you have to go through these ugly transition periods that are unpleasant for some people. And for me, no, I'm not talking about somebody who can't afford a place. So that's the worst thing. The idea of not being able to live near where you work, because that starts to that messes up the traffic. Because if you have people having to commute into the city to work entry level wage jobs, and they're spending more of their time on the roads are getting clogged. I mean, it's this whole sort of urban planning from almost like a symphony. You have to orchestrate it so well for it to really work. And when one thing doesn't work, the whole thing kind of wobbles and goes off center.
Yeah, well, I think so. What we're looking at are a lot of natural tensions within, you know, the city limits, which is the aesthetics. I think of the aesthetics of a neighborhood or the aesthetics of a city do matter, but they take a back seat, I think, politically to this idea of what's fair and what's not fair. Now, you mentioned something which I'm imagining, if John was here, John would say there's no such thing as economic redlining. Or that's all there is economic redlining. Redlining is when people of color or a minority or whomever aren't allowed to live in a particular place. Has nothing to do with whether they can afford it or not. To then suggest economic redlining, well, John would point out, I think, that, well, no, I mean, like, I can't afford to live in the most expensive. I couldn't afford to live in San Francisco, say. The only reason I can afford to live in Seattle is because I've been here so long that my house was dirt cheap when I got in. But the point is that John would say, listen, this is just a natural movement. You know, people have to get moved out. When more money comes in than the rich people live in, say, San Francisco, and most people can't afford to live in San Francisco, and then they move out, and the poor people move out. And that's sort of the capitalist system here. And I'm always arguing with him, yes, but I think a city loses something if we lose that kind of diversity, if we don't have this nice mix of lower income and middle income and upper income and diversity of races and a diversity of occupations and that kind of stuff, which he sees having no value. The battle for people like you and me, so we are both lucky enough and got in early enough that we have homes in single-family zoned areas in Seattle. And I love the aesthetics of it, but I don't know that I can defend the aesthetics of it over the fairness of it if we have basically economically aced out most of the city from being able to afford to live here. Right now, my home is nowhere near the average price of a home in Seattle, but still, it's a luxury to be able to live in Seattle. And if we got rid of a single family zoning, which we have partially by allowing for backyard cottages, and there are a lot of corners in my neighborhood that have been turned into condos, so it feels to me that sort of gradual, that seems to be something that we're going to have to bite the bullet on and realize, okay, can we put our mouth where, you know, our politics where our bacon is? Like, do we prefer to allow more people to be able to live in this city with us, or do we say, well, no, I was lucky, I got in on the ground floor before it became too expensive for people like us to live here, and you'll have to find someplace else to get in on the ground floor? Yeah, I don't know how you resolve that.
Well, I mean, policy-wise, I think the city, the county, the state have endorsed the policy of creating certain numbers of units of affordable or below market rate housing in neighborhoods as part of big developments. So policy-wise, that is what we as a society want. We want that mixture of economic diversity in neighborhoods so the people who are working the low-wage jobs don't have to travel from really far away. But this kind of thing, like the reason Ed Murray backed off of it and the reason why whoever tackles this, whether it's the next mayor, the next city council or how that's addressed, it's like a block by block strategy because everyone, like, I mean, I'll admit, if I saw something about, you know, single family zoning going away, I'd be looking around really carefully. I'd be looking at the Department of Construction and Inspection's website, looking for people applying for variances or applying for permits and trying to figure out the timing of if and when I would, you know, sell my house or build something on my lot rather than just stay here in my single family home. But because it's tricky. I guess I grew up in a fairly modest means over in the suburbs. We always had a single family house, and it was, you know, the dog could run around outside. You could ride your bike in front of this house on the street and stuff. And that's sort of the ideal. I mean, maybe that ideal is going away and maybe society is evolving and changing, and then maybe that's progress. But I guess for progress to really happen, I need to die, because it's like people like me are dinosaurs. And the longer that people like me or you or even are stuck in our single family homes that we love, standing in the way of progress, regulations or money or whatever, then you can't really move forward. Or you move forward in kind of a patchwork way, which is fine,
if you plan 20 years out, though, we may not know what life's going to be like in 10 years, let alone 20 years. And one of the concerns you might have is that, well, now that if people really start working remotely, maybe it won't be such a problem for people to live out in the suburbs. Remember, the irony about all this is that we liked urban density because it was a way to prevent, a sprawl. Well, now sprawl might not look so bad to people if they want their picket fence and their yard and their bicycle sidewalk streets. They can move farther out, and if you can work remotely, maybe that is a possible solution.
But when I go to a big city, like an old big city like Paris or London or New York or something, I love it there. I don't miss my single family home or my yard. I just think, great. There's all this cool stuff out on the street, and I'm 2 blocks from this museum and 3 blocks from that subway stop or whatever. But it's a different set of different criteria apply here in downtown Wallingford.
And I wonder if your average Seattleite would love living in Paris. I love Paris. It's the greatest city on the planet, but it's not the same kind of lifestyle that I have here in my little rundown bungalow in Greenwood. So I don't know, but that's the thing. We're all moving in that Paris, London tradition. I mean, you mentioned my mom, grew up in Ballard. My dad grew up in Wallingford. Ballard. We take her to where her house was. It's long been torn down. It's unrecognizable because of all the condos and all that. It doesn't mean that Ballard isn't still a great hub, a great urban village. It just means that for old Ballardites, they go, where's my city? You're right. We're all becoming dinosaurs. And if we're dinosaurs for, a good cause, if we lay down and die and allow for more to prosper, maybe that's just fine. But
dinosaurs for a good cause.
The final concern I have, though, is, they say why urban villages haven't worked is because they haven't kept home prices down and rents from soaring, and it hasn't stopped the displacement of low-income residents. I can imagine let's say they raise every single family home in Seattle. We may put up multiple condos and apartments. I'm not sure that that's going to guarantee that we can keep, home prices and rents from soaring or to not displace black residents. It seems to me that, at least on average now, on average, white homeowners or white residents, white citizens, will always have more money than, your average black, at least, in our lifetime. And if that's the case, then they're going to be able to outprice the minority for affordable housing as well. I don't know.
So we're doomed. We're doomed is what you're saying. Either way, we're doomed.
That's right.
Okay, good.
Let's both run for mayor. Okay, we're running real late. But thanks for that meaty discussion, Felix. And we'll now turn to Tracy Taylor to rescue us in the trap. Welcome back to the final half hour of the 5 o'clock hour of the Tom and Curley Show. Tom Tangney here. John Curley away, feeling a bit under the weather. Felix Bunnell has been filling in for him. This is a story. Oh, and by the way, before the segment's over, Felix, I want to get to that unbelievable Mariners game yesterday.
Yes.
John often wants to point out, we're not a sports station, but every so often, once in every 15 years, there's a game that's worth talking about for our general audiences. And last night was just such a game. So we will get to that before the segment is over. But there's been, John and I have been kicking around this fascinating, I think, article called The Myth of Panic in Palladium magazine. And it's so long. It's one of those that John and I have to give ourselves enough time to kind of, work our way through it before we're ready to talk about it. So we decided to spring it on you since you had no time to prep at all. Because it's 15 pages of pure history and sociological analysis that is just, it's so rich with possibilities and is relevant now. It starts back primarily in the talking about not I was going to say like a last century, the 20th century, back in 1950, when we were operating upon a certain philosophy of engagement that revolved around disputed but at the time accepted for given as gospel, that we as a society or a country or a nation have to be careful to make sure that panic doesn't grip our citizenry, and we'll be worse off for it. And this goes back to the 19th century, a theory that was accepted for over a century and a half, that this is indeed how to control people. Why don't you take it from there?
Yeah, and it was applied a lot in the 20th century, this notion of, well, there's this bad thing is happening, and we can't let the people know about it because they're going to panic, and it'll be even worse than the thing we're trying to protect them from. They're going to be more dangerous to themselves and the community than this thing we're trying to protect them from, whether it's kind of illness or some kind of a weapon. The part of it that stuck, a couple things struck me with this piece. One is this notion of in the time of the Cold War, when we figured out that the Soviets didn't have just bombers, long-range bombers that we'd know about coming over the horizon with the distant early warning line, but they had these intercontinental ballistic missiles that could get here in a matter of minutes from Moscow or from wherever they were launched from. And there was theorists who said, like, boy, if the American public figures out that, the panic of fearing an attack like that is going to be worse than the nuclear weapon itself, which is a pretty potent way to look at it. It was essentially proven wrong, and it was proven wrong really notably during World War II.
Yes.
In the run-up to the Blitz, where the Nazis figured, we're just going to bomb London so many times, bomb the civilian population, they're going to lose it and panic, and Britain will capitulate and surrender, we won't have to invade Great Britain. And the opposite happened. They noticed what they called a social utopia theory, this notion that people under duress, whether from enemy attacks or whether it's some sort of severe weather event or something, they actually become nicer and nicer to each other. Now, they also have to be prepared. I don't think the people in Great Britain just sat there waiting for the Nazis to start dropping bombs. They did all this stuff like these air raid precautions. The government put bomb shelters in people's backyards and gave people buckets of sand that in case the incendiary lands on your roof, you're trained what to do with it. And so it really did brought people together, and the Nazis pretty much gave up after a year of trying to bomb London into submission because it didn't work. And so that's the part that really stuck. It just persists because we fail as a society to remember the really important lessons. We don't remember that panic isn't something that we have to worry about. We have to use the information to inspire fear in people.
Yeah, and the suggestion is here, and this is where I think the John Curleys of the world might glom onto this, that it's really the elites who are trying to manipulate the masses.
Yeah.
By saying that you can't trust the masses because they only turn into mobs.
Yeah.
And that's really a classist approach to theory, and they say everything seems to work against it. And then you always have, in a good argument that you make, you always have to acknowledge the counter argument, and they give some examples. Like in most of these public health crises, things have worked out pretty well. But when you just inform the public of exactly how dangerous it is, you don't try to make light of it to deny them the information. The one time that they give an example is in British India, where there was plague control, and the native Indians went berserk, according to the British. They were shooting and killing British doctors and the like, and they said that was not because they didn't trust them. It was that they did not do anything to make themselves understood. They didn't speak the native language. They had no respect for Hindu religious beliefs, little knowledge of local burial and customs, and so they were reacting to a cultural affront, not to the fact that they were so afraid of what they were going to do, that's an example of we just need to be more culturally sensitive, which is interesting. Here's how it fits into today's world. How did we handle COVID? The people that think that we can't tell the world how dangerous it is, there are two schools. One is, it's not that dangerous. You're overplaying the dangers. The other school is, no, it's really dangerous. We need to alarm, the people to let them know how really dangerous it is. In this particular case, the myth of panic is, if we were told from the get-go exactly how dangerous this thing was, we would have all reacted and rallied around the flag better than if we're given these sort of half-truths to kind of protect us from whatever information we're getting or not getting.
And the lesson that will be remembered from that is that the in this case, government officials weren't giving the full truth. And so the trust is eroded. So I hope that part's forgotten the next time a pandemic. I hope people don't remember how bungled it was at so many levels in terms of holding back information that should have been provided to people. The same thing that President Trump was telling to Bob Woodward during those interviews back in February or March of last year.
and what we were risking by
bad,
not
Bob.
Trying to panic people.
It's really bad,
okay.
Bob.
Okay, now, perfect. I said I wanted to get to the Mariners game.
Yes.
This is we only have time enough for a quick clip, but just setting this up. We got off to a bad start, I'd say. We were down 6-0 to the Houston Astros, the hated Houston Astros, who are, I think, the best record in baseball. And we're down 6-0 in the first inning. And by the third inning, we were down 7-0, and we slowly and surely came back when all should have been lost. And it ended up in the eighth inning with us hitting a ball, and I won't tell you what happened, but here's the clip.
Now the left-handers, 1-1 pitch to Dylan. Swing and a well-hit ball, deep to left field. Grandma, get out the rye bread and mustard. Grand salami time. Upper deck, left field, down the line. Dylan Moore with a grand salami, and the Mariners lead the Astros 11-8 in one of the greatest comebacks I've seen in a long, long time.
That video, Dylan Moore swinging the bat, the way he connects with the ball, the way his, I think he's a right-handed batter, the way his left foot lifts up for a second and flaps down, he just connects, and the sound, and he knows right away, he points to the crowd, he knows within a millisecond that thing is going up into the upper deck above the Edgar sign in far left field. What a cool thing. I hope they can hang on through August and September. Oh.
Yeah, amazingly enough, we didn't give it up. Our bullpen didn't give it up in the ninth inning. We shut them down right then and there. And, that's good. We haven't played a Mariners clip in a long, 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 long
time. 1995. Rick Riz sort of said it out of order about telling Grandma about the mustard and the bread and the grandma salami.
That's right.
He didn't quite have it right. There were a few pieces not quite in order there about the grandma salami mustard or something.
Anyway, congratulations to the Mariners. I think they're 9 games above 500.
Wow,
I can't remember the last decade where I could have said that.
Well, I think how disappointing August is going to be. Wow.
Now, go M's. Okay, that's great. We've gone on long enough. Tracy Taylor, how are things looking on this glorious day out on the highways? All right. Welcome back to the Tom and Curly Show. Our favorite moment of the show is when we look over the horizon and see all those great letters being carried by the mailman.
I'm the mailman. As you can see, I'm the mailman. Don't nobody mess with me. I'm the mailman. If you didn't know, I'm the mailman. I bring the mail to your door.
All right, Felix, who's filling in for John, who was feeling under the weather today. Why don't you kick off our lengthy letters?
All right. About that absence, 425 says, oh, my gosh, did Curly finally catch the COVID?
Well, now there would be a story. We also hear from Andy in the Road Less Traveled. We hadn't heard from him for ages, and now it's 2 days in a row. Hi-ho, fellas.
Wow.
And a special hi-ho to my favorite Seattle-based FM radio historian, Felix.
It's a little too specific. Come on.
That's right. You're his favorite Felix Bunnell. Hey, do you reckon it was hearing from me that caused John to call in sick today? I hope not. That's it. Have a great rest of the week, and go Bo Sox.
And from Dead Rat in the Blower Motor, Michael, I know Mr. Curly is on in today, but I hope he feels better soon.
There you go. And area code 253, all this concern for John. Did he catch the Covfefe?
About mask recommendations for the 7 counties in Western Washington, 206 says, I'm vaccinated, so no mask for me, period. I've been shopping every day inside Walmart today, and nope, not needed.
And area code 253, oh, does this mean that Jay Inslee is going to bring out old reliable again? Well, he has a press conference called for tomorrow, so stay
I thought
tuned.
That was going to be about the Apple Maggot quarantine area. 206 says, I think it's a ploy to get more people to vaccinate.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing.
If so you can wear a mask.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm confused. That's like three-dimensional chess there. Sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't work. Nick from Orcas. I wore a mask to keep myself and others safe before there was a vaccine. Now that I'm vaccinated, I'm protected. And I'm not entirely interested in protecting the idiots who have chosen to be unvaccinated.
Wow. And 425 says, masks aren't a big deal to you because you're not trying to do physical labor or construction work. Yeah, good point. That's true.
Yeah. Yeah. Simone Biles, area code 425. Tom, Felix, just imagine if Russell Wilson got us to the Super Bowl. The Seahawks were the heavy favorite. And the night before, Russell decides he's not in the right headspace and won't play in the game. Just sits on the sideline. Not physically incapable, just mentally off. I'm sorry, but Simone Biles has spent the last 4 years preparing for the Olympics. She took a spot on the limited roster and then quit the night before, leaving her teammates high and dry. I'm in my 30s, and even I'm suck it up, buttercup. Our athletes these days have the weakest mental fortitude I've ever seen. She took a spot to represent the U.S., and as a representative, she quit. What message does that send to the world? Wow.
Harsh. I don't even know who the backup quarterback for the Seahawks is. 206 says she was having a severe panic attack. If you've never been in one, don't judge. It's horrible. And this is coming from a tough 56-year-old man.
I like that both of those listeners included their ages as a bolster to their argument. I'm not sure.
That's good. And area code 253. Baseball is 90% mental and the other half is physical. Yogi Berra.
I love that. That's brilliant. Oh, man. Thank you for that. I'm really glad that was mentioned. That's
And we miss all these great articles about urban villages. Man. Good talk about urban villages. Okay.
And now it is time for the letter of the day.
Thank you, Teeny Tiny. Letter of the day comes from area code 206. And yes, it's about John. I call BS on John being sick. He doesn't need to go anywhere. He doesn't need to dress for work. He's not on camera. He's out with Dougie. I want to see hospital documentation. Well, we'll see. Yeah, I'm sure, if nothing else, John always comes back with a story. How accurate it is, how truthful, and how fictional will be up for us to decide. But anyway, hope you are back soon, John. And again, thanks, Felix, so much for filling in at the last second. You did a heck of a job with a lot of meaty stories, as you put it.
Oh, so meaty. The meatiness is just, the meatiness is overwhelming.
That's all she wrote.
That's all she wrote.
She left the room a-hanging round.
That's all she wrote.